Hi, and welcome to the Kubernetes podcast from Google. I'm your host, Craig Box. There are two types of people, those that would pay whatever it costs to go into space, and those for whom there's not enough money in the world that you could pay them to go to space. Which are you, Jimmy?
You know, Craig, I've been watching the news, and I just think about growing up in Florida in the space shuttle era, right? And I always dreamed of going to space camp or, you know, going up in the shuttle, going in space. But, you know, I have a few thoughts about this now.
Please share them with the group.
Well, you know, now I'm a granola living in San Francisco, so I have a few more priorities for humanity before spending that kind of money.
Do you think that the argument that this is just the start and that eventually there will be trickle-down benefits for the rest of the world, do you think that holds water?
You know, it sounds very familiar and very American, but I'm not sure I'm signing on to that one.
You've really got to look at the cost per minute when you think about these things. Like Jeff Bezos's rocket ride was 11 minutes end-to-end with 3 minutes of weightlessness. I think I'd sign up if you could have an hour in space, but 3 to 4 minutes... Not that I can afford it, obviously, but it's a tough economic decision.
It's a definite flex. And I'll say this, I have two things about this. You know, 3 to 4 minutes of weightlessness after a bumpy ride on capitalism's phallus doesn't seem worth it to me.
There were a lot of Dr. Evil comparisons made. I do remember watching Austin Powers in the theater many years ago. And there's a very funny scene, which if you haven't seen, we'll have a link to a version of it in the show notes. Many of them were going around Twitter this week.
Whoever designed that rocket had to know. I mean, they had to know, right? That's a thing.
How do you feel then about the Branson approach where we have a plane launched off the back of another plane?
Actually, I thought that was really efficient and elegant. And I said, right, this is the future of space travel. That actually felt really cool.
But you said that in 2004 when Bert Rutan first invented it.
Oh, I must have missed that one. I was out of the country.
I don't know if you remember, but there was a contest called the X Prize 17 years ago, which was basically $1 million to the first people who could go to the edge of space twice within a 2 week period or something like that. And an aircraft designer called Bert Rutan won that contest with something that looks very much like what Branson has now. And then Virgin invested in it and said, we'll make this a product. And they took a long time, but credit to them, they did get there.
I'll say that I'm impressed with the flex. These men are definitely showing their power, but my version of that is just getting a little more guacamole at the local taqueria. So I can relate.
I got double salmon in my poke bowl the other day. That was a treat. Poke bowls in Britain are definitely nothing on Hawaii or even continental America for that matter.
Well, I'm going to start calling you Mr. Branson then.
Or Mr. Powers. Danger is my middle name.
Shall we get to the news?
Let's get to the news. If this week's episode whets your appetite to learn more about secure software supply chain, Google Cloud is hosting a webinar on container security, featuring talks from several previous podcast guests and all-around good people. You can watch it live with Q&A next Thursday, July 29th, or catch up on demand afterwards. Google Cloud also announced that registrations for Google Cloud Next 2021 are now open. The event is to be held October 12th to 14th and is fully virtual, which will come in handy as someone went and scheduled a KubeCon at the same time. Both events are completely free to attend, and links to sign up can be found in the show notes.
GCP this week has added a new cloud intrusion detection service in preview. It provides broad visibility into traffic coming into your cloud environment, as well as east-west VPC traffic from GCE or GKE endpoints, looking for malware, spyware, command and control attacks, and other network-based threats. It also detects exploits and evasion attempts at both network and application layers. Cloud IDS integrates Palo Alto Networks threat detection technologies as a full first-party Google service. Google also added Windows Server container support to Anthos clusters running on VMware, and multi-cluster ingress, a feature previously only available to Anthos customers, can now be used by GKE customers without an Anthos subscription.
Carrying on the security theme, an exploit was discovered in the NetFilter system in Linux, which can bypass all modern security mitigations and achieve kernel code execution. A write-up by Google information security engineer Andy Nguyen explains the CVE in great depth, including how it was discovered in the context of a Kubernetes capture the flag escape. Vendors are publishing advisories this week, but the bug was fixed in the kernel in April.
A security advisory for Kubernetes. If you have access to edit endpoints, then you can expose certain pods to the internet, even if other security controls would prevent you. This is another one of those part of how Kubernetes works bugs, but a workaround is provided while the design phase starts on a proper fix.
A security advisory for Helm. If a username and password was provided to fetch a chart, and that chart referenced a second chart, the first username and password may have also been sent to the second server. Their behavior has been fixed in Helm 3.6.1, with the old mode now behind a flag in case you actually needed it to do that.
Security company Intezer has detected a new attack on Kubernetes clusters running Argo workflows. Misconfigured dashboards allow internet attackers to drop a request for crypto mining into a cluster. In one case, a cluster had been mining Monero for 9 months before anyone noticed. You can check your Argo endpoint from outside your cluster, or Intezer's software will detect and alert this kind of thing for you.
Rounding out the security section and linking last week's episode to this week's, Sysdig has acquired a policy. As the name would suggest, a policy is an infrastructure as code tool for applying policy across your pipeline based on the Open Policy Agent. Terms of the deal were not disclosed, but I happen to know that a policy CEO may or listens to the show, so hello and congratulations from us.
Cockroach Labs has announced general availability of their database operator for Kubernetes. The CockroachDB operator is based on learnings from their cloud service and handles scaling, redundancy, and automation of deployment and upgrades.
Cloudflare had a problem with Kubernetes nodes failing, and after extending the node problem detector to properly detect their node problems, decided they wanted something else. Serio, with a silent C, is the Latin root word for squirrel, and the name of Cloudflare's solution. It uses Prometheus's alert manager to set node conditions, rather than requiring something running in-band on the node. The nodes can then be queued using queued, with a K.
Finally, if you want to learn more about operators, the CNCF App Delivery Tag, formerly SIG, has published a white paper. It defines and provides a comprehensive guide to cloud-native operators, outlining patterns, recommended configuration, and use cases. It also offers best practices, including advice if you want to write your own operator.
And that's the news. Priya Wadhwa is a software engineer on the Google open source security team. She works on supply chain security, focusing on SigStore and Tekton. Welcome to the show, Priya.
Thanks for having me, Craig.
Your first job at Google was working on developer tools, things like Minikube, Scaffold, and Kaneko. Was security a big concern while working on those tools?
Interestingly enough, we had always kind of talked about how it was probably something that we should be doing more, just because there were all these binaries that we were releasing that a lot of people were running. But to be honest, I was so focused on responding to issues and adding new features and kind of the day-to-day of being a maintainer of an open source project that I never really had a chance to focus on security.
Perhaps not so much about the security of the software that you were releasing yourself, but on the way that people would use your tools to build things that then they would want to be secure. Were you ever getting feature requests in that related to that?
Honestly, I don't remember it being a huge topic at all.
Right.
Mostly we would get requests for features or for bug fixes, but that was pretty much it. When supply chain security kind of became a bigger conversation in recent months, that's when I also, like many people, started to think about it and started to realize that I had actually been really lucky with the tools that I had been working on, that nothing really bad had happened yet. And there was a lot of room for improvement, that ideally I was looking for an easy way to add more security to the tools that I was working on.
I think that's true of a lot of things, especially related to the internet. These things start out as very academic things that are very open and people are very communicative. And then as they become more popular, people start seeing the opportunity for abuse and for security malfeasance and so on. And then all of a sudden, there's a tipping point in the consciousness where it becomes something that's very important.
Definitely. I think the conversation is really important because obviously prevention is
mightier than the sword, I think, as the expression goes.
Exactly. Prevention is preferable to a reaction. Ideally, security would be so easy to do that everyone would just be able to do it without having to put too much effort in, and a lot of potential attacks could be mitigated that way.
I hear a couple of different descriptions of what a software supply chain is. If you think about the physical world supply chain, then you might think about the dependencies of your application, the compilers and the libraries that you bring in. Alternatively, you could think about it in terms of all the things required to take your app from code all the way into production through compiling and linking and building binaries and so on. How do you think of software supply chain?
I think of it as kind of a combination of what you described. I guess a simple way to put it would be it's the journey from the source code you write all the way to production, or that piece of software ending up in a user's hands for them to use. So at the very beginning, it could include anything like source code, dependencies, build configuration, and then every step along in the process to actually getting it out to the person who is going to be using it.
If we think about some places where people may have come across security in the technology that they use, perhaps you think about the App Store on your phone, and you're downloading an application which was built by someone, and they had to sign it themselves and upload it to a store, and there's some proof all the way through that what you're getting was approved and signed in such a way that the phone can only run things that were signed by the vendor. Is that an example of software supply chain?
I think that is an example of software supply chain. One of the ideas behind software supply chain is that the end user should be able to verify the software pretty much from the root of where it was created, ideally, and be able to verify that the software is coming from the person or entity that they expect that it should be coming from.
Another thing which has been discussed recently, especially in Linux circles, is the idea of reproducible builds, as being able to take a set of source and then make sure that the binaries that are provided by your packaging system, you can prove that you can build them from that same source. Is this related?
I think this is related. Verifiable builds or reproducible builds can provide security in a couple different ways. On one hand, when you're actually building your reproducible software, you could build it multiple times in multiple different environments and make sure that you get the same thing every single time. And it's one way to ensure that your build system itself has not been compromised. Mm-hmm. And the other nice thing about reproducible builds is in the open source context, I could build something and someone who is using my software could build the same thing as well and verify that what I'm giving them is also what they expect to be receiving.
A way that all of this has reached people's consciousness recently is through the SolarWinds hack. And there has been a lot of response, especially from the American federal government now, to say, we don't want this kind of thing to happen again. There was an executive order recently from President Biden to say that this is something now that government agencies need to think about. What happened in the SolarWinds hack?
In the SolarWinds hack, the attacker was able to gain access to the build platform that SolarWinds was actually building their software on. Mm-hmm. And on this build platform, they installed a malware service, which would inject malicious code into the final SolarWinds software that they were distributing to their customers. And it's an interesting hack because a lot of common mitigation techniques might not have caught it. Mm-hmm. Because the bad code was being injected in the build system itself, it didn't exist in source control. And so ordinarily, you know, you have reviewers looking at your code before it's merged. So because the code wasn't in source control itself, that wasn't a way to catch potentially bad code. Because the code was being injected during build time, the final product was signed by SolarWinds. Mm-hmm. And so people who were receiving that software, it looked perfectly legitimate. The other interesting thing is that typically, when you update your software dependency, you expect vulnerabilities to have been fixed if there were any. But in this case, updating the SolarWinds software was how the malware was distributed. This is actually a place where the reproducible builds could have come in handy, because if they had had multiple build environments and were building the same piece of software in multiple locations, they could have recognized that one of the build systems was compromised and generating something that was different to what all the other ones were generating.
Is that something that will become standard advice for people? Is for their risk profile, they should run builds in different places in the same way that someone might want to run cloud services in different regions?
I don't know how feasible it is for people to do it, but I think that it would definitely be an additional layer of security that has a lot of advantages.
Now, one of the things we've talked about at Google Cloud is the concept of binary authorization, and that's effectively a way of saying you have to have a signed binary in order to be able to run this application on Borg, and there are GKE and Kubernetes equivalents. That wouldn't have actually done anything in this particular case, I understand.
Yes, because the final software would have been signed, it would have looked legitimate, it would have been run. Whoever was running it would have seen, like, oh, it's been signed by SolarWinds, and, you know, the verification checks out.
So then people, I guess, are going to start saying, that's not enough. We need to have that. It's definitely a part of our security pipeline, but we now need to be shifting further left, to use the parlance.
Yeah, there's so many different kinds of attacks. So you have to be doing a combination of different things to try and protect yourself as best as you can. I'm sure new things will come up all the time and new strategies to avoid them will have to come up too alongside.
People talk about provenance in this particular case. Is that proving that something comes from a particular person by identity?
provenance, I would say, is more of a record of how something was built.
Right.
The idea behind provenance is if I build my software artifact, my provenance statement would include things like the Git repo that I pulled the code from, the specific commit that my artifact was built at, any environment variables I might have set, and the exact command that I ran to actually build the software. The idea behind provenance is to get as much information as I can about how a build was conducted so that if someone ever wanted to have more information about it, they could get it from the provenance. A lot of times people will generate provenance for their software and they will assign the provenance itself so that it can be proven that the provenance came from them.
Right. So I guess the signature is where the identity comes in, because in the art world, for example, you talk about the provenance and says, well, someone saw Rembrandt paint this and then it was sold and bought by these people and so on. And if you can get that chain all the way back to the artist, then the art is worth a lot more money. But when we're talking about reproducibility and so on, it doesn't necessarily matter that Rembrandt was involved. It just matters that anyone knows the steps that were taken and could be taken by somebody else.
Exactly. But the signature is still really important, because without the signature, there's no way of confirming that the provenance is correct.
So this brings us to the InToto project, which is in the CNCF. They talk about farm-to-table provenance for software.
InToto is a provenance format, and it basically focuses on providing provenance to help maintain supply chain integrity. The idea is that InToto is uniquely defined to help contain any supply chain metadata you might want included as you're going through the supply chain.
And those are the things you mentioned before, like the environment variables and Git commits and so on that we used.
Exactly.
Is that a set of tooling that helps create and verify that metadata, or is it just a format in which you can describe it?
It is just a format in which you can describe your supply chain build, but a lot of SigStore tools have native support for the InToto format to make it easy to store attestations in a specific place and also query for attestations with specific data inside them.
Now, you mentioned SigStore there. That is a project with the Linux Foundation to address a few of these software supply chain concerns. Can you talk a little bit about how SigStore was started as a project?
SigStore is a project in the Linux Foundation. The main goal behind it is to basically make signing and verification for supply chain metadata really easy and transparent. The entire project is open source and free to use. It's kind of going back to what I had said before about my own personal journey. At the time that I was working on the open source Kubernetes developer tools, it isn't even just that security wasn't a huge part of our day-to-day conversation, but there was no easy way to do it. The goal of SigStore is to fill that gap and make it easier to sign and verify software in general.
There are a lot of tools in SigStore that are related to containers. Is it a container-only project, or would you say it was containers first?
It was containers first, but the goal is to support other types of software as well. I know that we have work going into supporting WASM modules and adding InToto attestation support to our transparency log. So I think we started with containers just because there was no really easy way to sign containers at first. So it seemed like an easy first step. But the goal of SigStore is in general to make signing and verification easy for software in general.
Now, that first step was a project called CoSign. I guess that's like the sign project, but 90 degrees offset.
Yeah, exactly. So it stands for container sign. Mm-hmm. It's pretty much exactly what it sounds like. It's a tool for signing and verifying containers. It can be used to sign other pieces of software too. That's pretty much it.
I guess I'm surprised that's not something that was already built into the spec for OCI, for example.
Yeah, it just speaks to how maybe supply chain security was not at the forefront of everyone's mind until recently.
Where does CoSign fit into my build and release pipeline?
If assuming you are building containers, CoSign could be used to verify the base images that you are building on top of and make sure they are coming from the source that you think they're coming from before you actually build your images. Once you've built your images, CoSign makes it easy to sign them so that any consumers of your image can verify that they are actually coming from you. It could be useful in terms of, like, if we want to make it specific to Kubernetes, maybe you want to verify all of the images in your deployments before you deploy them to cluster. I think there's a tool called Connoisseur, which is basically a Kubernetes admission controller that I was reading about the other day that leverages Cosine to verify images before allowing them into your cluster.
So am I just effectively signing it at this point to say, this is something that was built by me, or am I somehow relating it back to the provenance we discussed?
So you're signing it to say that it was built by you. You could have provenance included to provide more information about how the image was built. But the signing itself is basically you saying, I built this thing and I am signing it, and you can verify that it came from me.
How do I verify who you are in this particular case?
Cosine supports just using like a classic public-private key pair. So you generate your key pair, sign it with the private key, and then make your public key public, and people can verify it themselves if they want to. Using a couple of the other Sigstore tools and services like Recore and Fulcio, which is our certificate authority, can make this even easier. So people don't actually need the public key to verify your image.
Now, a few weeks ago, we talked to Dan Lawrence, who's on your team, and he was talking about a key signing ceremony to kick off the root of trust for presumably the Fulcio project and Sigstore as a whole. How did that process end up playing out?
Oh, it was really fun. Did you get a chance to watch it?
I didn't, but I hope that he wore a robe and wizard hat, as I had been promised.
That would have been awesome. But yeah, the root key signing ceremony went great. We did it on a live stream, had a good amount of viewers. I was one of them. People were verifying that the root keys were coming from the people they were supposed to be coming from and verifying the metadata as the process went on. And yeah, now we have 5 root key holders for the Sigstore project.
So how do I go from those 5 trusted people to one of them presumably has to sign something on behalf of Docker, for example, and say, well, if Docker, the company, want to publish something, they're creating their own key, and then it will be signed by one of those root people, and perhaps then they could have an authority which allows their customers to be signed by them.
First of all, I think one of the benefits of having 5 root key holders is that a majority of them need to be present to be able to sign anything at all. So it would be probably at least 3 root key holders in this scenario. I think that we are working on making our root key available to other open source projects as well. I think if it was to be done today, it would have to be done manually. We would need an open source project to come to us and say, oh, we're interested in having our key signed, your root key, and we would have to manually verify that it was legitimate. But I think there are plans to try and automate this process in the future.
Speaking of automation, one of the things you work on is a product called Tecton Chains. How does that tie into Sigstore?
First, I think we can talk about how it ties into Tecton.
Right.
Because it was created with that in mind. A simple way of explaining Tecton is it's CI/CD for Kubernetes. The idea is if you want to run your CI/CD system on your cluster, you can use Tecton and you can leverage common Kubernetes resources like secrets and volumes to build your final software artifact easily on cluster.
So I have an object in Tecton called a CI step, for example?
Yeah. So in Tecton, we have this concept of pipelines and they execute different steps. One of those steps could be analogous to a step in your CI system.
So where do chains come into the picture?
The basic idea of chains is that it is supply chain security for Tecton. Say you've had your Tecton pipeline running for a while and it builds your OCI images for you. It pulls in your Git repo, builds the image, and then uploads it to a registry. Tecton Chains was designed to run alongside Tecton and take care of all of the supply chain aspects of your Tecton build pipeline. It's still in early stages, but right now we do 2 things around supply chain. So the first one is that Tecton Chains will watch your Tecton pipeline and wait for it to build artifacts, and it will sign them for you. If your Tecton pipeline is already building an image and pushing it to registry, Tecton Chains will recognize it and sign your container image for you with whatever pre-configured keys you have set up. The other nice thing that Tecton Chains does is it will create provenance for you using the InToto attestation. So for each step that you have already running in your Tecton pipeline, Tecton Chains can create a corresponding InToto attestation that will have all the information around what image was run, what command was run, and any other data people might want to know about how the final piece of software was actually built.
Where is all that data stored, and how do I get access to it if I've got the name of a container, for example?
In terms of Tecton chains, the data can be stored in a location that you would configure. So you could store it in your GCS bucket or as an annotation on your Kubernetes object itself or wherever you want. If you want the information to be publicly available so that consumers of your image can find the attestation themselves, then that's where the SigStore services come into play. So you could, in theory, store your attestation in Recore, which is our publicly available transparency log. And then anybody could query the log in the future and see the attestation for the image that they are searching for.
So far, we've talked a lot about the process of building software, which we presumably have the source code for. But a lot of the source code in people's software starts with import this open source project or pull down this library from a repository. Now we start worrying about the bill of materials required to build software and the potential that there is not just problems in our own code, but in code that we may not even know that we're using. So how are you looking at the concepts and problems behind maintaining this bill of materials for open source software?
For anyone who might not know, SBOM stands for Software Bill of Materials. Basically, the idea behind them is that for a piece of software, the SBOM will contain a list of all the dependencies and probably at what versions those dependencies were built into the final piece of software. Theoretically, this could be useful if, say, you are looking for a specific dependency that you know has a vulnerability in your software and you want to make sure that you're running a newer version or something. But I think that most SBOM generator tools are still in early stages. I don't think any of them are recommended for production use yet. The whole area is still early.
Would that create an artifact that would eventually become part of the provenance of the binaries?
I think it could be useful if you had an SBOM similar to provenance. It would detail all of the different dependencies that went into your final artifact. And if you were to sign that SBOM, it would lend some validity to it. But I think right now it's still unclear how to generate a correct SBOM for any given piece of software.
A lot of interesting work has been happening in this space from Google lately. There is a project called Open Source Insights, or a dependency graph tool, which generates some really interesting pictures showing you might have a very small amount of your own code, but there's an iceberg sitting under the ocean that you sit on top of.
Something that Dan, who I work with, likes to say, and I'm going to steal this from him.
By all means.
Is that if you find a thumb drive on the ground, you are not going to plug it into your computer and see what it is, right? But most people who are writing code will pull in open source dependencies without thoroughly checking the code that they're pulling in. And when you think about it, both of these things are not very safe. And yet one of them we would definitely not do. And the other we kind of do without really thinking about it.
But again, that's a thing that's changed over time because, for example, there was an alternate reality game around a Nine Inch Nails album, maybe in the early 2000s. They had all these hints to things hidden in pictures and so on, and I remember hearing that they put them in flash drives and left them in the bathroom at a concert or something, and people would take them and find them, and obviously don't do this in production, but maybe that's a thing that people will think twice about doing these days.
Yeah, exactly. This is where the Open Source Insights project comes in. It's unlikely that I will go through every single dependency, direct and indirect, that I pull into my project. The Open Source Insights project aims to do it for you, which is nice. The idea is you can go to the webpage, I think it's steps.dev, and type in your open source library that you want to use, and it'll give you some information about, like, basically security-related stuff, like, oh, were CVEs found in this library? Does it appear to be safe? It's kind of a way to take the work out of deciding if you should vendor something in or not.
I have heard of cases where people have acquired access to an open source application and then gone and put something in secretly. So perhaps that's a thing. It's not necessarily true to say this is safe, but it's to say this is safe at this time or at this particular version.
Exactly. Nothing is 100% certain, but it's useful to just have a guide. The Open Source Insights project goes hand in hand with the Scorecards project, which is another open source project that my team works on. Mm-hmm. The idea behind Scorecards is that it will assign a security score to a GitHub repo based on a collection of metrics that have been decided upon. The same metrics are applied to every single GitHub repo, so it is standardized. And the idea is that you could go to a repo, look up the score, and it would help you decide if that repo is secure enough or you are comfortable using the tool from that repo or vendoring in the code in it.
Another thing that was recently introduced by the Google open source team is SLSA, S-L-S-A, or Supply Chain Levels for Software Artifacts. What can you tell me about the SLSA project?
The SLSA project is basically a framework around supply chain security. The levels range from SLSA 1 to SLSA 4, with SLSA 4 being the ideal and most secure setup for your supply chain. The idea behind it is it aims to protect you against the most widespread supply chain attacks. And so it's a set of standards at each level will guarantee you a different level of security.
No one thought to name the levels mild, medium, and hot.
That would have been great. Level 4, extra spicy.
What kind of things change as you go up through the levels?
Level 1 is the most basic level and basically includes a couple of things, scripted build, and that there is some sort of provenance generated for the software that you are building. Mm-hmm. As you increase levels, obviously, there are more requirements. And so SLSA level 4, which is the most difficult to achieve.
I dare you to eat more than 10 in one session.
Will require that things like your source is version controlled and that you have two people review every single PR before it's merged and that your build is hermetic so it doesn't have network access while you're building it. And so a lot of these things may not even be possible right now with like really common build systems that people are using for their software. So though SLSA level 4 is the goal, the reason the lower levels are there is because it might not be feasible for everyone to achieve level 4.
And the SIGSTOR projects will obviously help provide some of those things that tick off the checkboxes as you move up those levels.
Definitely.
Does it seem fair then to think about a future where it's just on by default that everything you do is signed and the metadata and the provenance is published and available?
For open source, it's definitely possible to get to a point where all the software that's being consumed is signed and there is provenance for everything. Obviously, it would really depend on if the tools could be easy to use, but also broad enough that most people would be able to apply them to their specific use case, which is always a tough line to walk. That would be the ideal outcome, that adoption is huge and everyone starts signing everything.
Even when it comes to tooling, you might not want to use it. You just want to know that everything is good until something isn't. And if someone tries to sneak something in, then just because all the infrastructure is there, you know that something can't run unless it was signed, and by default, everything is signed.
So verifying goes hand in hand with signing, right? Signing something isn't super useful unless somebody on the other end is making sure that it's coming from where they expect it to come from.
It's like doing backups without doing restores. I guess from what I've heard so far, like you've put a lot of effort into signing and having this stuff be available. You really do that so that it can all be verified, and that can be manually verified in some cases. But at the rate of change of software, it almost makes sense just to assume that it will all be automatically verified and then only alert people in a case where there's a fault.
Definitely. And that's where automated tooling for verification also comes in, like the Conestor project that I mentioned earlier. But one of the key parts of SIGSTOR is that it's not only open source, but it's also transparent. All the certificates that are issued by FullSIO, which is the certificate authority in SIGSTOR, or all of the entries that end up in SIGSTOR's transparency log are all available to the public. So yes, it's important for people to sign things and add them to the log and make sure that people know that they've done it. But on the other hand, people also need to be auditing the log and making sure that everything looks good. And if something sketchy happens, that they bring it up and they know that it has happened.
Now, you can judge the validity of a new concept in the cloud native ecosystem by when it gets its first KubeCon pre-day. And this upcoming KubeCon, we have Supply Chain Security Con. What can I expect to learn there?
Oh, it's going to be exciting, Craig. I can tell you that much. We're going to be talking about supply chain security, obviously, probably in relation to KubeCon, but I think it's just going to be a lot more about what I've been talking about today. Stuff about SIGSTOR, stuff about Tecton, stuff about some of the big hacks that have happened in the past few months, but just a lot more.
And if you want to learn more about this a bit sooner, Google Cloud's also running a container security webinar next week.
Yeah, I'm excited to see it.
I look forward at least to the ubiquity of all of this technology. It's great to know that there are people out there who care about this technology, but to me, I think it will be more successful when it blends into the background, and I know that I'm safe without having to stress about it myself. So what things do you think need to happen before we get to that world, and in what way can people contribute to the effort?
Right now, most of Six Store tools are not GA, not ready for production. And so a good first step would be to get more contributors on board, continue to add features that people are looking for, and really stabilize each of the tools and services that Six Store offers so that people can actually start using it and start using it in production.
And if this is something that people want to contribute to, where would you like them to go?
Sixstore.dev is a good starting point to learn about each of the tools and services I've mentioned, or visit our Slack channel. I promise we're super friendly and we would love to have you.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us today, Priya.
Thanks, Craig.
You can find Priya on Twitter at PriyaWadworth16, and I did check, and 0 through 15 were all taken.
Yeah, it's a really common name.
Thanks for listening. As always, if you've enjoyed the show, please help us spread the word and tell a friend. If you have any feedback for us, you can find us on Twitter at KubernetesPod or reach us by email at KubernetesPodcast@google.com.
You can also check out our website at KubernetesPodcast.com, where you'll find transcripts and show notes, as well as links to subscribe. Until next time, take care.
See you next week.